According to historian Chauncey Sanders, there are three basic tests that can be applied to any historical document to determine its reliability. These tests are the same for both secular and sacred documents. There are no exceptions for either category. If an historical work is trustworthy, it will pass these tests. If it's not, it won't. The first test is the bibliographical test, and it asks the question, is the text we have now a trustworthy transmission of what was originally written? That is, when we are reading, in this case, the Gospels, are we reading what Matthew and Mark, Luke and John actually wrote? The Gospels pass this test in a way far surpassing any other ancient document. Both the quality and quantity of ancient manuscripts that we have surpasses any other thing we have in the ancient world. For example, no other work boasts even half the number of the manuscripts we have. Now, a manuscript is technically a copy in the original language. We have 5,800 plus copies in Greek, ancient copies in Greek of the New Testament. The closest competitor is Homer's Iliad, for which there are fewer than 2,000. So the New Testament has more ancient manuscripts than its closest competitor by almost a factor of 3. Not only does it have more, but they are older. In the case of Homer's Iliad, again its closest competitor, the oldest surviving manuscript of Homer's Iliad was copied 400 years after the original. Was anyone told in school that what the Homer's Iliad that you were reading in class, which we read it, I don't know about you, actually, we read the Odyssey, maybe a little bit of the Iliad. But did you ever hear a teacher say, well, now this thing you're reading, this may not be at all what Homer said. Even though the oldest copy we have was written 400 years after the original. Whereas in the case of the New Testament, we have manuscripts that date within 50 to 100 years of the original. To call into question the integrity of the actual text of the New Testament and the Gospels is to call into question all of ancient history, something no reputable scholar is going to be willing to do. You and I can be confident we have a reliable record of what was originally written. But that's not the question before us this morning. The question before us is the second test, the internal evidence test, and it asks this question. Does the text bear marks of credible history? Some skeptics will say, well, you may well have what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John originally wrote, but it's not believable. What you have are carefully copied frauds. These works are so steeped in bias. They are so ridden with contradictions, discrepancies, and unrealistic claims, they were never credible to begin with. What you have is a carefully copied National Enquirer. It was bogus from the beginning. Are they right? If you read some of the evidence put forward by these detractors, it at first, some of it can seem compelling. But upon close examination, what do we find? Well, let's take up the issue of bias. Were Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John biased? 20 plus years ago, there was a documentary, quote unquote documentary, about Jesus that aired on cable television. And it led off with this statement by the narrator, quote, most of what we think we know about Jesus comes from the New Testament Gospels, but we can't trust those books for accurate information because they were written by the converted. They were written by people with bias. So here's my question. Were Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John biased? Absolutely they were. They were among the converted. They were believers. They were not neutral concerning the claims of Christ. Should it surprise us that most of our information about Jesus should come from biased sources? Anybody read a book on archery or cooking or some other area of interest? Who wrote it? Someone who believed that thing had value. It's the people who believe something has value who want to see it passed on. So yes, they were biased. Did they have an agenda? They most certainly did. Luke told Theophilus what his agenda was. I'm writing this that you may know the certainty of the things in which you were instructed. I want you to know that these things are true. I'm trying to help you see that they are true. John said near the end of his book, John chapter 20, verse 31, these things are written so that you what? May believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So, if someone looks at you and me and says, the Gospels were written by people who are biased, you and I can put a smile on our face and say, you're right. But the conclusion that because authors are biased, they cannot be trusted, is illogical. The mere fact that a writer wants to prove something does not make the writer unreliable. An innocent man accused of a crime may have a deep interest in proving his innocence. But this bias is not a reason to dismiss the evidence he produces. Oh, I'm sorry, you're trying to prove to us you're innocent. We can't trust anything you say. The survivors of the Holocaust, they wrote down their experiences, and they were not neutral bystanders. And why did they write them down? Because they believed passionately, I want this recorded so that we never repeat it again. Shall we distrust all the things they wrote? People can be objective without being neutral. That's a very important point. People can be objective about presenting material without being neutral about what they want to happen with that material. A doctor can give an objective diagnosis even if he has strong feelings for the patients. In fact, his passion for the patient may cause him to be all the more diligent in diagnosing and treating the disease. Passion will cause some people to exaggerate, but it will drive others to be all the more meticulous and accurate. So, the question is not, were the gospel writers biased or had an agenda? The question is, did they report accurately? How do we find out if they reported accurately? Well, we're focusing on internal evidence right now. We're not looking at the third test, which brings in extra-biblical literature, which mentions Jesus. And Jesus is mentioned by a whole bunch of authors outside of the Bible. All kinds of them. They talk about his crucifixion. They talk about what people believed about him. They talk about a number of things about him. And a number of figures in the Gospels are mentioned repeatedly. But that's not what we're talking about. We're just talking, if we had only this book, if we were on a desert island and came across this book and we had absolutely no background at all, and we began to read the Gospels, what about them would indicate to us that this is reliable history? Well, for one, we would notice that they are written in a very sober, sensible, and non-sensational fashion. You don't find outlandish flourishes and blatant mythologizing in the Gospels like you do in a lot of other ancient writings. They're written with obvious care and exactitude. The narratives are very restrained. And if anything, things are understated. Have you ever noticed that? And he was crucified. Now, if someone were writing a novel, or they were inventing something to try to impress, what would they do? Probably start elaborating on that. Here's what happened. He was crucified. Jesus healed his ear. Jesus did this. Understatement. It's almost as if they are just acting like objective reporters. And notice the things they include. In the study of history, there's something called the criterion or principle of embarrassment. And what that is it says that an historical account is more likely to be true if it includes embarrassing or damaging details about the heroic figures or about the person writing it. That makes logical sense. Because when we invent stories, the stories we tend to invent or tend to exaggerate are stories that make us look better, not worse. So here are the apostles, part of the foundation of the church, the holy apostles whom Jesus is going to send out into the world, who speak the very words of Christ. And what do the gospel writers tell us about them? And some of them were apostles, telling on themselves. Three times in the Gospels, we see the apostles jockeying for position. First time, they're debating who's going to be the greatest on the road. Jesus, they're not thinking Jesus is overhearing this or that he knows about it. And then they get back, they get stopped at night, and he goes, what were you talking about on the road? What were you arguing about on the road? And what do? They get all quiet. They do just what children do, because they knew they shouldn't have been doing that. They're embarrassed. In the second case, James and John get mom involved. And in the third case, they're debating about who's going to be the greatest in the very place where Jesus has just had the Lord's Supper. They've celebrated the Passover, and he's told them, one of you is going to betray me. You wonder if that's the thing that got the dispute going. This is not making them look good. Why are they telling us these things? Why do they tell us that when Jesus was arrested, they bolted and fled and abandoned him? Peter, the one who's always listed first among the apostles, one of only three to whom Jesus gave a name, the one who's given the keys of the kingdom. We're told that he gives this impulsive answer, doesn't he? Does your master pay the temple tax? Yeah. He officially goes in, Jesus preempts what he's about to do and talks with him about it. He fails on the Sea of Galilee. Here he is walking on water, and then he loses faith, and he begins to sink, and Jesus grabs him, and what's Jesus say to him? Not harshly, no doubt, but what did Jesus say? Oh, you of little faith. On the Mount of Transfiguration, Mark tells us, here they are seeing Jesus and Elijah and Moses. And Peter says, well, let's build these three tabernacles. And you remember what Mark says? Why did Peter say that? He didn't know what to say. What do you think John was thinking? There's no reason to say anything. Peter felt the need to say something. I can relate to that. There was no need to say anything, but he felt like something needed to be said. He didn't know what to say, so he opens his mouth and he inserts foot. Why are we being told this? This is Peter. Why are we told that Peter takes Jesus aside and has the audacity to say, oh no, you're not going down to Jerusalem and do the things you just said you're going to do. And the scripture tells us that Jesus turned from Peter to the disciples. And what did he say? While Peter is apparently behind him, get behind me, Satan. Why are we being told this? Why do we have Jesus coming to Peter, James, and John, and they're sleeping on the job, and Jesus singles out Peter, Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Peter denies Jesus 3 times after he said he wouldn't, and then the 3rd time he starts cussing to emphasize his point. Why are we being told these things? Why are we told that Thomas doubted, and then Jesus says to him, well, blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Why are we told that the apostles were rebuked for their hardness of heart because they wouldn't believe those who told them that Jesus had raised from the dead? These things are deeply shameful, some of them. Why include them if you're just inventing a religion and you're trying to write something down that you hope will sell people on your ideas and the people in your system? These things don't read like legends. When legends pop up about historical figures, the hero tends to become more heroic, not less. It's very unlikely that later apostate Christians would have written these sorts of things about the holy apostles. People like that would not have written things like this. The inclusion of these things tells us that not only were these historical writers, the gospel writers, trying to give us honest history, but it also tells us they were written early. And a number of other things tell us that too. But we're not done. I'm going to have to skip some material here. Who were the first ones to the open tomb that Sunday morning? Women. Who was the first person to whom Jesus appeared? Mary Magdalene, a woman. Who were the first people to come and tell the apostles that Jesus had risen from the dead? The women. And you're like, well, okay, I hear the common thread. What's the big deal? Josephus was born something like AD 37 or 38. So he was born right in this time period. He was a Jew. He was born into a priestly family. He became a Pharisee at the age of 19. Listen to what he says about testimony in Jewish courts. But let not a single witness be credited, but 3 or 2 at the least. We know where he got that. And those such whose testimony is confirmed by their good lives. Now listen to what he says. This Palestinian first century Jewish man. But let not the testimony of women be admitted on account of the levity and boldness of their sex. The testimony of women apparently was not even legally permissible in first century Jewish Palestine. And yet 3 Jewish men, Matthew, Mark, and John, related that women were the first witnesses. Women were the first to tell the apostles. And women's testimony, when it was rejected by the apostles, they were rebuked for rejecting it. Abdu Murray is a man with roots in the Middle East and Lebanon. I'm going to read you a paragraph. Bear with me if you will, but listen to what he says about this. The Bible records that the first people to lay eyes on Jesus' resurrected body were women. This is not a mere scrap of narrative detail. In the first century Middle East, a woman's testimony was worth half that of a man, if it was worth anything at all. Yet the gospel message that Jesus had risen from the dead was meant to take root in that very context, where people believed that, where men believed that. This aspect of the Bible's account is of utmost importance for at least 2 reasons. First, it lends credibility to the resurrection narrative. Consider this. If the gospel writers had invented Jesus' resurrection, would they have made women the first eyewitnesses of the fact? No, they would have made men the heroes and the witnesses. Choosing women as the first eyewitnesses would have been laughable to the Middle Eastern mind, making the account less acceptable. The gospel authors would have no incentive to write that account unless that is how it actually happened, and that's what they wanted to tell. Matthew's Mark chapter 6 says, quote, Jesus could do no mighty work in Nazareth because of the people's unbelief. That seems to limit Jesus' power. Why would you include that? Matthew 24, Jesus says he doesn't know the day or hour of his own return. That seems to limit his omniscience. Why include that? Mark chapter 1, Jesus is baptized when he had no... How many here have wondered about that? Jesus is baptized when he had no sin. What's going on there? That raises questions. Why include that? In Matthew 27, Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Does that raise questions? Sure does. If you're trying to sell people on a religion and give them something that they can absorb easily and just buy into, why include these things? If I'm going to invent a religion, why would I make it have the Savior say, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect? Logical explanation is that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were including these embarrassing, inconvenient, damaging, hard to explain, roadblocks to faith details because their goal was to record what actually happened. But John, the Gospels contain contradictions. For example, I read Jesus saying one thing in Matthew, and then I go over to Mark, and he's saying the same thing, and yet he's saying it in different words. In fact, he even adds a few things or doesn't include others. I see differences in language throughout the Gospels. This is the most common kind of difference we encounter in the Gospel parallels. Now, we're quite used to this being students of the Bible. But to someone on the outside looking in, this can raise questions. And even in us, I think it can raise questions. Have you ever noticed? When Jesus is baptized, he comes up from the water, the Father speaks from heaven, and what does the Father say? All right, I just heard some people quoting it. Matthew chapter 3, verse 17, Matthew tells us, God said, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. In Mark chapter 1, God says, you are my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. In Luke 3, you are my beloved Son, in you I am well pleased. None of those statements is identical to the others. The pronouns are different. Did God say it three times? I don't think so. What's going on? And this is one of many, many, many examples we could cite. What is going on? Well, what's going on is the ancient practice of paraphrase. In the ancient world, truthful quotation did not equal necessarily exact quotation. They weren't used to tape recorders. Well, we don't even use tape recorders anymore. Can you even buy one anymore? They weren't used to recording technology. They didn't have it. You can look at ancient historians and you can see that they would record speeches. They would summarize them. They would condense them. They would shorten them to fit their narrative purposes. This is quite common. You can look at Thucydides, Herodotus, Josephus, Xenophon, the writer of First Maccabees, and you can see that they did this. The people in the ancient world, yes, they were able to quote verbatim, and there's evidence that they did so at times. But to them, you did not have to give an exact quotation to give a truthful quotation. And that really shouldn't surprise us. We do it all the time. Please go tell mom, I said this, this, and this, and this, and see what she says. What'd she say? Well, she said, and, you know, I've got some children who just kind of have a, well, I can't remember the exact words. That's all right. What did she say? And they tell me what she said. But they don't give me an exact quote. We do this all the time. Language is a reflection of how people think, and it is noteworthy that Greek and Hebrew did not have quotation marks. In fact, in English, we've only had quotation marks since the 16th century. If you're a King James user, have you ever noticed? There are no quotation marks in your King James Bible. And think of what quotation marks do to the way we think about something. As soon as you put quotation marks around something, what's that mean? Those were the exact words. And if you change it even the least, what do you have to do? You got to put it in brackets. If you take something out, you got to put ellipse. Ancient Greek and Hebrew had none of those things. They did not think of quotation as we do. It was not a demand made on the ancient historian. And we are reading an ancient Mediterranean book. It is foolish, uninformed, and ignorant to judge it by modern Western standards. We just want to remember that. Well, I see differences in details, though, John. When I start looking at the Gospels, I see, sure, I understand that you've got different witnesses, and some are going to include certain things, and others are going to include others. That makes sense to me. But I see some things that don't seem to fit into that category. For example, the man who said, legion, for we are many, having all those demons. I go to Mark and Luke, John, it says there was one man, but I go to Matthew, and it says there were two. The women in the tomb in Matthew and Mark, it said one angel met them, but in Luke, it says two met them. And in Matthew 20, it says Zebedee's wife, that may have been Salome, she and her two sons come to Jesus and ask, and she asks, can one of them sit on your right hand and the other left? But when Mark records that, John, it's only James and John. They're the ones asking the question. She's not even mentioned. These are contradictions. This is where it becomes very important for us to understand we are reading an ancient book. A gentleman by the name of Michael Lacona examined the writings of Plutarch. Plutarch wrote in the first century. He wrote 60 biographies. 50 of them have remained until our day. Mr. Lacona took 9 of his biographies, called The Lives. He took 9 that concerned people who were contemporaries and whose lives overlapped each other and who knew each other. Now, Plutarch had written biographies of each one of these, but because their lives overlap, some of the same things are written in each one. So he got parallel accounts. And he made a careful study of this, and what he found was that Plutarch used a number of what we call compositional devices or techniques in his writing. And some of these things may even be discussed in ancient textbooks telling you how to write. And one of them was spotlighting. And what's spotlighting? It was a technique which emphasizes one individual to the neglect of others. That's what's going on. It's not that Mark and Luke are telling us there was one man only, but apparently there was one man who was more predominant in the situation and may have been the spokesman. Same way with the angels. But yeah, but what about that thing with Zebedee's wife and the boys? I mean, Matthew says she asked the question. The other account says they asked the question. Doesn't even mention her. Well, this is interesting. Mark's doing some spotlighting. He focuses on James and John. Why would he do that? Matthew's account shows us if we can see beyond the English. Matthew tells us that Zebedee's mother comes and she falls before Jesus and she says, can one of my boys sit on your right and the other on the left? Jesus answers with this, Matthew 20, verse 22. You do not know what you ask. Who's the you? He's like, well, it's Zebedee's mother. The you in the Greek is plural. Those are actually verbs. They're all plural verbs. Furthermore, he goes, you do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink? The question of if you are going to be able to drink the cup, who would that be directed to? That's James and John. In other words, Matthew tells us that the mother of those boys verbalized the question, but when Jesus answered, who did he direct the answer to? To them. You know, 2 verses later, when the 10 heard what had gone down, who were they upset with? It says they were upset with the 2 brothers. Why weren't they upset with their mom? You know, either mom had that idea and the boys really liked it, or they had gotten her in to plead their cause. But either way, the sons of thunder were the ones that question was coming from. And in ancient tradition, spotlighting, the mother was removed from Matthew's account to focus on the two who were really asking the question. In ancient biography, this is not unusual or unheard of. It strikes us as odd. But we're looking at it from a modern Western view. But what about the chronological discrepancies, John? Here I am in one gospel, and there's this event in Jesus' ministry, and it's in one place, and then I go to another gospel, and it's in another place. Well, sometimes that happens, for sure. And it's a reason that many reject the Bible's history, the gospel's historical reliability. Well, what's one possible answer to that? Let's say, nobody ever do this, please. Well, let's say you decided to write a biography about me over the course of 2 or 3 years. You're focusing on my teaching. Okay, so John went to Pleasant Hill, Iowa, and he presented the lesson saying, and you give a condensed version of what I say today. 6 months from now, I'm at Murray Road or I'm somewhere else, and John stood before the crowd and John spoke saying, and the same message. Of course, it's different because I word things differently. I exclude some things, I include others. Did Jesus ever teach the same parable more than once? Almost certainly. Did he ever give the same teaching or do some of the same things more than once? Almost certainly. So some of those apparent discrepancies can be explained that way, perhaps. But there's more to it. Again, we have to realize we are reading an ancient biography. Do the gospel writers anywhere ever say, I am giving you a sequential order of Jesus' ministry? None of them ever says that. And unless they categorically state that and then fail to follow through on it, we have no grounds to expect it from them in light of the culture they were writing out of. Now, having said that, I do want to share something interesting. And we know John's gospel is quite different from the others. These are the three that are often called the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They look the same. They include a lot of the same material. Sometimes Matthew and Mark will agree about the order of something and disagree with Luke. Sometimes Mark and Luke will agree on something and not agree with Matthew. But if Matthew and Luke agree on something and Mark mentions it, they always agree with Mark. It does appear that Mark is quite likely giving us the actual order of Jesus' ministry. And I'm just curious, looking into this, I picked up a Harmony of the Gospels that I have at home, and I opened it and started paging through it, and sure enough, Mark goes down the center column, and all of that's in chronological order, and the others are the ones that are skipping around. It's interesting when you look at the Gospels. It does appear as if perhaps sometimes things are organized thematically and to make certain points. Now, let me just look at one example of this where we've got a different order, but we do not have a discrepancy. Luke often will introduce a new event with the Greek word kai, K-A-I. And the word kai means and. It can mean even, also, but it's not a time word. It just means here's something else. In the temptations in Matthew, there are three. In Matthew 4, Jesus is tempted to turn stones to bread. Then he's taken to the pinnacle of the temple. Then he's taken up onto a high mountain. All right, those are the three in that order. And when Matthew introduces the second temptation, he uses the word then. So there's order. And then when he gets to the third temptation, he says, again. So Matthew's claiming here is the order. Now we go over to Luke, and Luke starts with the stones to bread, but then he switches the order of the second and third. And you're like, oh, we've got a contradiction. But if you look at the words Luke uses, he doesn't use then and again. Even though my New King James, it's the only translation I looked at that does this, it uses then in Luke, but the Greek word does not bear that out. And the New King James, the New American Standard, the ESV, they all just translate it and. He uses and. He's not saying one came after the other. He's just saying here's an additional temptation and here's another temptation. We wouldn't do that in a modern Western thinking. But this was not unusual and unheard of and not unacceptable in the ancient world. One more quick thing about that. No, we're just going to skip it. Let's look at the final thing. Miracles. This is the kicker for a lot of people. There's a British scholar by the name of Peter J. Williams. He wrote a book, Can We Trust the Gospels? I've really benefited from the book. I actually emailed him, and he emailed me back. We've written a couple times. Kind of cool when you have an author write you back. And he writes this near the end of his book. Were it not for the many miraculous reports in the Gospels, most historians would be very happy to treat the Gospel accounts as generally historically reliable. That is no small thing, he says. Think about that. He's saying these historians look at the Gospels, and were it not for the miracles, they would accept them as reliable historical witnesses. So do we have a historical objection or a philosophical objection? Well, John, you know, we've learned a lot about science now, and we've proven that miracles are impossible. Back in the ancient world, you know, they didn't know what we know, and so they bought into this stuff. It was in a pre-scientific world that people believed things like the virgin birth and the resurrection. We know better than that now. What would you say in response to that? What's that? Well, all right, fair enough. Okay, so yeah, we know more about the science of conception. Just take the virgin birth as an example. And we know more scientifically about the way death happens. But are we any more sure than they were 2,000 years ago that when people die, they don't raise from the dead? That's a weird question. My point is this. Did people 2,000 years ago know that it took two parents to conceive a child? Did they know that when people die, they don't get up from the dead? They knew that. They knew what was natural. That's why they were able to identify what was unnatural. And they saw the miracles that Jesus did, and they were so unnatural that they concluded they must be supernatural. Scientific thinking has not made us any more certain about the basics of the natural world than they were thousands of years ago. So that's kind of a moot point. But John, I've never seen a resurrection, and I don't know anybody who has. There was a Scottish philosopher in the 18th century by the name of David Hume. And it's been said that our culture suffers from a Hume hangover. David Hume argued the following. He said you can really only believe a thing if it's probable. And a thing is probable only if it conforms to uniform and consistent human experience. Notice that word. Uniform. What's uniform mean? Same. So miracles, since they're outside the uniform testimony of experience, are improbable, he says, and therefore they are not worthy of being believed. Now there are lots of problems with what Hume just said. One of them is it proves too much. What proves too much proves nothing. That's a really cool statement. If you have a statement and then you follow it to its logical conclusion and it takes you to some place that's not true, that tells you that what you started with wasn't true. If we can only believe a thing if it's not unique, if it matches up with normal human experience, where does that take you? It takes you to places you don't want to go. In 1819, a man named Richard Whately took Hume's philosophy and applied it to the life of Napoleon, a very unique individual. And based on Hume's philosophy, you have to discount huge amounts of whatever happened in Napoleon's life because things happened that had never happened before. You don't want to go down that road. Dr. Lawrence Burkholder, a man who had been greatly influenced by Hume, he started realizing this himself. He's like, you know, really every historical event is to some extent or in some way unique. He said, I'm beginning to feel the limitations of Hume. What Hume said also assumes what it attempts to prove. What did he say? Uniform experience. How do you know that everyone's experience is uniform through human history? C.S. Lewis really said it well. Now, of course, he says, we must agree with Hume that if there is absolutely uniform experience against miracles, if, in other words, they have never happened, then, of course, they never have. Unfortunately, we know the experience against miracles to be uniform only if we know that all reports of them are false. And we can know that all the reports of them are false only if we know already that miracles have never happened. We are arguing in a circle. He begins with the assumption that there are no miracles and they've never happened, and then argues from that that there never will be. And this is really, I mean, you know, most people we talk to are going to know who David Hume is, but they do think like that. I remember being with Jeff Yost in Gregory probably about 15, well, we were canvassing on behalf of Gregory in Raytown about 15 years ago, and we met up with this guy. You know who John Mayer is? It's okay if you don't bother Googling him and figuring it out, but this guy looked a lot like John Mayer. I said, have anybody ever told you you look like John Mayer? Yeah, I've been told I look like John Mayer. So he's a young man. We talked maybe 45 minutes or so. Toward the end of the conversation, he looked at Jeff and I, and he goes, what about the resurrection? And built into his question was this premise. People don't rise from the dead. On what grounds can he say people don't rise from the dead? He could say it because of his experience and the experience of people he knew. But I could also say a number of things about history that wouldn't be true, but did turn out to be true about Napoleon. Bottom line. We have first century testimony that Jesus performed miracles and that he rose from the dead. We have four witnesses just in the Gospels. We have Paul writing 1 Corinthians, maybe only 20 years after Jesus' resurrection, saying that he rose from the dead. We have all these witnesses. Jesus appeared to people in all these different environments, 12 different appearances. All these claims that he rose from the dead, and all of that from the first century. When someone we know, or we're talking to, says to us, well, I've got these alternate theories. You know, it was really the wrong tomb, or Jesus was just mistaken for being dead, or a whole host of other things. We ought to ask them, can you please name 3 or 4 first century sources that support your theory? See, we are operating from evidence. They have a theory. We are operating from evidence. We can follow theories or we can follow evidence. There are no first century accounts that offer other explanations for Jesus' supposed miracles. Did you realize that? We have nobody, not even one from the first century who says, well, yeah, there was this fellow named Jesus, but he really didn't perform miracles. All the witnesses we have say, yes, he performed miracles. And even the Jewish Talmud, they say, well, he was a sorcerer. We have no one from that time period saying he didn't perform miracles. So are we going to follow the evidence or are we going to follow theories? If we follow the evidence, we'll follow Jesus.